Welcome to Dog Talk and Kitties Too. I'm Tracy Hotchner. I'm here for everyone who loves dogs and cats, talking to experts and authors every week about the animals who share our world. Thanks for listening on Long Island's only NPR station, WLIW-FM 88.3, where Dog Talk originated 13 years ago. Listen to podcasts of the 700 previous shows in the library at RadioPetLady.com, along with Cat Chat and my other Pet Talk podcasts. Dog Talk is a production of Pet Media, Inc., which is solely responsible for its content. This show is brought to you in part with the generous support of Woruva, a family-owned pet food company that makes a vast variety of high-protein recipes for cats and dogs in cans and pouches using human-grade ingredients, which are prepared in a facility that makes food for people. This show is also made possible by Dr. Elsie's Precious Cat, a privately-owned company founded and run by Dr. Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian in Colorado who personally engineered all of his specialized litters. Dr. Elsie's is also the founding sponsor of the Cat Film Festival, which is now streaming alongside the Dog Film Festival for free on Amazon Prime and Tubi TV. Today's guests are Dr. Megan Herron, talking about purebred cats and how they're different. Then Mark Beckoff will be here talking about his article for Psych Today, Do Dogs Know They Are Dying? What Do We All Think? And Steve Carino will be here talking about his book, Oliver, The True Story of a Stolen Dog and the Humans He Brought Together. I am here yet again with the pleasure of being with Dr. Megan Herron, one of the co-editors of Decoding Your Cat, The Ultimate Experts Explain Common Cat Behaviors and Reveal How to Prevent or Change Unwanted Ones. And Dr. Megan, I had talked to you off the air, just a vague question, and I got somewhat gales of laughter from you. I would love to just step away from the book for one second, and as a behaviorist and a fellow with 99 other co-behaviorists, is there a profound difference in not only all purebred cats that are purpose-bred from your average domestic short-haired cat, but what about certain breeds of cats, whether it's the Orientals or certain substrata of purebred cats? Do they lack some of the primal core drives that drive a regular cat, like prey and kill, or do they have them even more so?
I'm going to say it probably depends on the breed, but in my own personal experience, one of my favorite kitties was a Sphinx. His name was Mr. Gerard Bigglesworth. It was a negotiation with my husband on the naming when I told him we were getting a bald cat. But I've never had a more high maintenance cat in my life. And, you know, I came prepared for kittenhood with all of my toys and my scheduled play time and my multiple litter boxes and my cat tree in every room. And boy, was I in for it. I mean, you didn't have time off.
No kidding.
That seeking, hunting, I got to play all the time was there. And I was new to the breed. And as I made friends with others who have Sphinx, that is not unique to him. And I know I've talked to a lot of people. Maine Coons are another high maintenance breed. All they seem like big, gentle giants. I've talked to so many people who've had to lock their pantries because they're stealing food. They can't be satiated. So that, again, if we're not providing for these needs, sometimes even the purebreds can be, I would say, equal to the same needs as our domestic friends, if not more so in many cases.
Sounds like maybe more so. The Orientals are much more vocal, and I guess that's a fair generalization, right?
Yes.
Whether it's your Siamese or perhaps Burmese and some others. Mm-hmm. But do they have a higher drive to interact with us? Do they need more social interaction? Is that something that people should be aware of? Because I think they mm-hmm. say, this could be an exaggeration, that a third of the cats in shelters may be purebred cats. So you think, oh, wow, I'm getting a Persian for free, so to speak. I don't have to wait mm-hmm. on a breeder's list. But we're rag dolls. I think in the book Decoding Your Cat, it says it's the number one most favored purebred cat, although a teensy proportion of people have purebred cats. Are there some whose needs are just so high that you have to make it, you know, like your personal mission to, okay, I will now be handmaiden to a Sphinx or handmaiden to a Burmese cat?
Sure. I think, well, there's kind of two questions. The first is the Oriental breed. So,
right.
And they're being so vocal. So I think what the difference between purebred cats and the domesticated cats is that there's a lot more artificial selection at play. And what that means is rather than natural selection, which is as nature is driving the genetics and the sort of shape and behavior, we as humans have selected for certain physical traits, and along with that come behavioral traits. So as over the years we have selected for a certain look, I think we also have cats that are selecting for highly social behaviors towards people.
Right.
And that's going to make them a lot more communicative. And so those vocal Siamese, that's sort of the stereotype, right? You get a Siamese, get some earplugs.
Yes, really.
You're gonna hear from them all day, every day.
Yep.
And anecdotally, that's definitely been my experience. But I think, again, that has to do with how humans have selected for appearance and behaviors come along with that. And possibly we're selecting for very social animals. These are bred to be house cats,
right,
to be with people and to be social. So it's definitely the case.
So it sort of,
and then your other question about certain breeds that stand out is really, you're going to just sign up for a full-time job. I'm going to have to go with the Bengals taking number one seat.
No kidding.
All of my Bengals. I mean, you think about that. They're crossbred with a wild, you know, they're a wild type. But
yes.
I mean, they're very vocal. They're wonderful, fascinating creatures. Oh my goodness. Like I have not so many, but a few Bengal patients that I've had have been just wonderful, incredibly unique characters, but they are high maintenance, and their families. I mean, the families I've met, they knew what they were in for. They just, some of their cats showed a little bit of abnormalities outside even the realm of normal for a Bengal. But, you know, they want social interactions. They want hunting opportunities. They want to dig. They want to chew. They want to talk. And if you're not meeting their needs, you're going to know about it with where they pee. That may be your pillow. That may be your shoe. They're very expressive with urine marking if we're not careful. So I feel like of all the breeds to take number one as high maintenance, that's probably going to be the Bengals.
That's really interesting. I've had Anthony Hutcherson on the show because I've met him actually at the Dr. Elsie's booth at the various pet conferences that I go to. And I fell so in love with a kitten that he had. If I didn't have cat killing Weimaraners, there's no way I would have left that Orlando hotel without that kitten, because he said, I'm not sure if I should keep this one. He had, you know, God knows how many dozen cats at home. A kind of beauty that is breathtaking, but charm and adorable and sweet. And he's always got them going around on a wheel in the Dr. Elsie's booth. And it never occurred to me. And the wheel is really cool and fun. And they sell those wheels, and anyone could have one for their cat. But I never quite got, it's sort of like some of the thoroughbred racehorses that I had over the years as show horses. In order for them to perform as a show horse rather than run a mile and a quarter, they basically had to be worn down every day, exhausted by lunging or by various other things in order to take that edge off. And I guess that's what you're saying, this high energy drive. That if you just look at it from the outside, you say, what a beautiful cat. Oh, so affectionate. And it's loving. And this is so great. It's sort of like, be careful what you wish for, I would guess, in some purebred cats. I want a really loving social cat. Well, if you get that, that social loving cat wants a lot back from you. That's something I never really understood. And this book, Decoding Your Cat, really helps with that. That's what you're saying, is the demands on the human, they're immutable. That cat has been bred to want to socialize. It's not on your human agenda. It's when the cat wants it. The cat wants it. Mm-hmm. Is that about right?
Yes. And if cat doesn't get, you're going to find out about it in other ways.
Yes. And so a lot.
No, you're absolutely right. If you get in, you get out what you put into it, right? And so to get that, and again, these cats with great, wonderful personalities, to really get the enjoyable, wonderful parts of that, you got to have a cat, happy cat. And to get that happy cat, you've got to provide for their needs.
And that's work. You either have a full-time cat nanny, most people can't afford it or wouldn't know how to hire that person, or you do it yourself. And even though in your book, Decoding Your Cat, some of the chapters talk about play sessions don't need to be longer than a few minutes, under 5 minutes. However, it still has to take place and multiple times a day. It's not like, oh, I'm going to work all week and I'll play hard and good with my cat on the weekend. Be like cooping up a thoroughbred horse in a stall and saying, don't worry, bud, I'll let you out on the weekend. You open the door and, you know, boom. So I think that's probably the same thing with the kitties that, that have that high drive to socialize and interact.
Yeah. And it's not just play. It's social time. It's interaction.
Right.
It's training. I mean, there's so much more that that play for a few minutes is just a part of it. It's just a piece of the puzzle. You know, just spending time with your cat, one-on-one social time. And it's to their choice. Are they wanting to play? Are they wanting to sit in your lap and cuddle? Do they want you to read to them? Do they want you to touch them? Every cat is different. And it's hard to predict when you're picking out a kitten to know what kind of personality you're going to have. Which is why in some cases getting an adult is a little better if you have information about their personality and have it match your lifestyle. But that one-on-one, just I'm just focused on you time is so helpful. You know, as a veterinary behaviorist, I see cats that have had, they have some serious pathologies and some of those do require medication. But what I tell my clients is, you know, just 20 minutes of your time twice a day is going to do so much more than Prozac.
Yes.
It really is. Not, and I've used Prozac very successfully and it saved lives in some of my patients, but that it doesn't replace that care, that time, that social interaction.
So the idea that a cat is a passive housemate for a human, he's there, he's on the back of the couch. And when I feel like it, I'll walk by and give him a stroke or, oh, I think I have a fishing pole toy somewhere. Maybe I'll haul that out, you know, with my skating equipment. It just doesn't work like that. I mean, there has to be a consistency. I think one thing that surprised me, because I didn't really understand this about cats, but I come from originally a horse and then a dog world, which is very much on a schedule. Horses in a barn, when they know that 4 o'clock is the afternoon feeding time for grain, they'll all start nickering and pawing on the ground. I mean, it's a really big deal. You feed them at exactly the same time because they're going to really act out. My dogs absolutely come and get me for in the morning. They could just as soon have a cup of coffee and a cigarette. As far as I can tell, they don't seem all that motivated. But when it's afternoon feeding time, they just come over and stare at me like, really, is your watch broken? And it turns out that cats are like that too. So that surprised me. And the book has a lot of things like their structure, predictability, and consistent interactions. How important is that to a purebred or a domestic, unpurebred cat, just a domestic kitty cat, that they can have a reliable time that you will play with them, where you will feed them, or you will be home? Do they stress if you come home usually at 6 p.m. and then it's 9 o'clock and you stayed late at the office?
Oh, I think most cats, purebred or domestic, short hair, are gonna have trouble with a major change in routine like that. Again, you're going to have variance to everything, where some cats are much more adaptable to changes in the routine, but you're going to have a large majority of them that are going to struggle with that. And it doesn't mean that we all need to live the exact same lives every day. It's that we provide things at least in a predictable order. I have families who they have a job that's unpredictable, that they get called out and their things change. But if what they can do is when they awake that their routine follows the same order. So we're going to have, you know, maybe we'll start with your breakfast. So you have your wet food on your platter, as you like to call it. That's your start of your day. Then we're going to have some one-on-one social time where I'm petting you and talking to you. And then we might engage in some interactive play. And then I'm going to start making my own coffee and have my own time. And I'm going to give you some treats and a food dispensing puzzle toy that you use on your own.
Right.
And you don't need me for that part. And so they're looking forward to each step. And by the end, it ends on something that they are sort of self-sufficient. I can self-entertain on this little food dispensing or whatever it is that the cat prefers. So then you can go about your day. And if your day isn't as predictable, your schedule changes. So the hours that occurs changes. You can at least try to insert this level of routine at the waking hours that you are with your cat. It can at least be helpful following that order if you can't. If you do have a consistent work schedule, then having them follow that same schedule. So if you have more time in the morning to follow through with all of these things, then that may be when you're engaging in more activities with your cat than it is in the evening. Trying to flip-flop back and forth may be a little harder. And what you might find is your cat's going to start demanding at their preferred time. If they've seen it both ways and they prefer, well, I'd rather play with you at 5 a.m. than 7 at night when it's convenient for you, you're going to find they're going to start asking for it at that time. And then you're going to have no choice but to engage in some way to combat that. So try to have a strategy and plan for, all right, because, you know, humans are part of the equation as well, and their needs matter. And so trying to find a compromise of, all right, well, I need to be consistent. I need to find a routine. But how is it? How can I do that in a way that fits my needs as well? And there is usually a way to do that, that meets the human needs as well as the cat's. But consistency and interaction is important, not just for being predictable, but so that they know, how do you want to pet them? Where are they going to be pet? How long is this interaction going to last?
Mm-hmm.
And that interaction is really consistent among family members. And for households with children, this is a great opportunity for modeling what is good behavior. So, as you've mentioned in our previous podcast, letting kids just go wild with a laser pointer, that's not going to be helpful for the cat. Instead, if we can make good choices and appropriate choices in how we interact with our cat, how we might use that laser pointer, or how we might touch our cat with 1 to 2 fingers on the head and neck rather than rubbing all the way down their back into their tail, we need to model that. Children will imitate us. I've got a 4 and a 6-year-old daughter, and believe me, when I hear them parroting my words, it's
kind of wonderful or kind of creepy, depending on what it is you said.
Yeah. So I want to, you know, if we were roughhousing with the dog, you know, the next day the kids are going to be doing that as well. So we have to check ourselves. Remember, is what I'm doing something that's safe and goodwill for my cat if my kid were to do this as well?
And
I
think
it's a great opportunity for modeling that.
It is. And it's also a great opportunity to teach humane thinking, so that if you don't just say, we're only going to touch the kitty's head and neck with these 2 fingers, and you would then go that extra step, which parents get exhausted by explaining everything, but it's part of what we have to put into raising another human. It's because the cat really doesn't like her body touched over there. And the reason she hisses or swats or even bites at you or scratches you, that feels bad to her. So we're going to do things that feel good to her, and she doesn't like a whole lot of it. And then you can even show the child by ruffling the child's hair or patting the child on the head, which is very unpleasant to humans, and show a kid that touching a cat in ways that don't feel good to the cat is going to wind up being an unpleasant ending for you, the child, or the human, the grown human. But it's because it feels bad to the cat, not the cat's mean or cranky. But you don't go over and jump on a kitty and wake it up on the couch when it's snoozing, because that's scary and upsetting.
Right.
So we don't want you, child, to get bitten or scratched. But the reason why the cat does it is the cat's scared. The cat's uncomfortable. I mean, decoding your cat made clear to me something I've never fully understood, that there are, and it talks about studies that have shown it, that many cats really only want to be touched on the head and the neck. And I've always known for quite a short amount of time, the minute the tail flicks, that's enough, bub. But the fact that for a lot of cats, the hind end of their body, so the idea of stroking from the head all the way to the tail, that you think, oh, that's a lovely massaging motion. For a lot of cats, that's way too much information physically. Just stop at their neck. If you want to do maybe their shoulder area, maybe, but why push the envelope? Don't you think that's an important part of the book, is it explains to people by talking about studies and observational studies that have been done, why for many cats something is just not pleasant. And if someone knew that it isn't that individual cat who's being crabby, or you person who has a bat, you're not a good cat guardian, is that this is a true thing for cats. There's things they really love and things they really don't love. And once you know them, you'd never do them again. I mean, Decoding Your Cat's the perfect title, Megan. I think it really is. It's like there's things you just have not even realized. And once you realize them, things are going to be a lot happier between you and the kitty.
I agree. And it's really all about creating empathy.
Yes.
So maybe we could have named it empathy for your cat.
Absolutely.
Because if we can empathize with how they're interpreting our interactions, we totally change our ways, right?
Empathy is the perfect word. And we're saying teach a child to be empathetic, but really what your book is doing is teaching grownups to be empathetic. Because if you're ignorant, that is to say you don't have the information, not stupid, but ignorant, how can you know? Mm-hmm. Until it's decoded, you're like, oh, I see. I think the book has a lot of, oh, I get it. There's a lot of that for me. So thank you for putting it together and thank you for being here. It's a great pleasure.
Oh, it's been my pleasure as well. Thank you.
This show is supported in part by Meet Me, a farm in Virginia that makes raw frozen foods and dehydrated treats for cats and dogs using their own USDA certified organic, certified humane, and non-GMO meats, all humanely raised and processed right on their own property, which is why they say ethical eats for companion carnivores from farm to bowl. This show is also brought to you by Merrick Pet Food, which began 30 years ago as a family-run company in Texas, where they're still making natural pet food. Their kibble is made without preservatives, fillers, or anything artificial. Their recipes are made under strict FDA guidelines, using only USDA-certified meats and fish, which are always the first ingredients in all their grain-free and healthy grains kibble. I am delighted to have back one of my absolutely favorite return guests on this show. There are very few people that come back more than once. Mark Beckoff has been here time and again. He has such an incredible column in Psych Today, Psychology Today magazine, which has been around since, I don't know, most of us were children. It's just such a longstanding, venerable platform for ideas. And one of his recent articles, Do Dogs Know They Are Dying?, really caught my attention because I think so much of us have an opinion or want to know, or is there a heaven and what's the rainbow bridge and do we know we're dying and do they know we're dying? Mark, thank you so much for coming back and for raising yet another really interesting, probing question. And because the fact that you're an ethologist and you study animal behavior, you also study human behavior in the process. And so I guess really you throw out questions to the universe and see what comes back. You never are a man with all of your great accomplishments who thinks he knows the answers. You look for new answers all the time. And I find that a really admirable and inspirational position to see the world from. So welcome back. And thank you for raising this question. And I'd love to know what came back to you.
Well, thank you for your kind words. I always say the more I know, the more I know, the more I say I don't know. I'm not underselling what we know about dogs. I mean, we know a lot, but, you know, I'm just lately been very interested in, you know, what different dog studies mean. Not that the science is bad, but that the dogs who are being studied are all individuals in different labs in different locations with different people and different human companions, et cetera, et cetera. Do dogs know they're dying question, or do they know that other individuals, maybe including humans, are dying, is really a fascinating one. And, you know, my general take on it has always been that I don't know that any non-human has a concept of death as we do, but it doesn't mean they don't have some concept of death. But I think for me right now, the most reliable answer that I could come up with is maybe a dog knows that he or she is dying. Maybe they know that other individuals have actually died, but we don't know that. And I don't mean that to dismiss the countless stories I have coming into my email inbox almost every week on, you know, saying that, well, my dog knew that she was dying, or my dog knew that her buddy died. But, you know, that's where I come down to. And having done a lot of field work on wild canids, I always go back to a situation that I called missing mom among wild coyotes. A mother disappeared. There was a pack of animals. The demeanor of every individual in the pack changed. They knew something was, I don't want to say wrong, but something was off. Mom wasn't there, and they were looking for her. You know, where's mom? But over time, you know, they just had to get back to business as usual.
Of survival.
They just had to eat and defend their territory raise puppies. There were some young puppies. And the reason I say that is just because when you do field work, unless you find, if you will, an individual dead or alive, you don't know if they died or disappeared. And so if when people say, well, they knew she died, and I'm going, no, I honestly don't think that they knew she died, but, you know, I hate to say it this way, but if there's anybody in the world that wants to attribute these active minds to dogs and other animals, it's me.
Right.
But the domestic dog situation is interesting, you know, and you know, I get emails saying, well, my dog knew, you know, she or he was dying, or my dog knew that their buddy had passed away. And I don't have a lot of compelling stories, but when you take the mass of stories, you know, hundreds, you just have to sit back and go, well, we just don't know. And that's basically where I'm at right now. You know, it doesn't mean we don't know. It doesn't mean we do know. But it raises all these fascinating questions about dog, you know, the emotional and cognitive lives of dogs. And it raises fascinating questions about dog-human relationships.
So let's talk about some of those. You said in the beginning that we don't know that dogs think of dying the way humans do. But then I would stop and say, but not all humans think of dying the same way. So there's those people who have various religions or various religious ideas about death. Some people welcome it. I mean, heck, terrorists can't wait to die. The ones who are told that they're going to go to heaven and great things are going to happen to them. There are very religious Roman Catholics, and I'm sure Greek Orthodox, and I don't think so much in the Jewish religion, where death is something to be embraced. And, you know, nuns and monks, you know, look forward to being to going to heaven, which they perceive as a place. Or in theory they do, right? Reunited with Christ or whatever their idea is. And I'm sure that in other religions there are similar ideas, whereas atheists or agnostics or less practicing religious people aren't really sure. And gee, they want a deathbed conversion real quick so something good does happen. So dying can be looked at as something quite positive for some people, or something like, oops, I better do my homework on my deathbed. And other people, you know, think dust to dust. So
right. I mean, I think what you're saying is really important. And I was going to use exactly that example that, number one, we aren't the template against which you measure everybody.
Right.
And number two, among humans, like it's the whole thing about grieving.
Right.
You know, people will say, well, dogs don't grieve. They don't grieve like us. Well, I didn't grieve when my mother passed away like one of my sisters, but I guarantee you she was grieving. So you really can't use humans as the litmus test, and you need to look at variability. So I had some dogs, you know, who I had more than one dog at the time, and then I had visitors coming every day. And when one of them passed away, disappeared, because I don't know in fact that Jethro knew his buddy just died, he didn't seem to be grieving at all. In fact, you know, he seemed like, okay, she's not here right now. Well, that's okay. But others, you know, in other situations, I've had people, you know, tell me that their dog has just stopped eating, stopped playing.
Yes, absolutely.
And I've seen that too in one of my dogs. So the fact of the matter is, just because you don't see something, you can't make inferences about what they're feeling.
Well, in fact, the very idea that dogs are one thing, that all dogs are alike in one way, and that would be something that you, as an observer, knows very well, that there is no one way that dogs act in a dog park, no one way that dogs act when they're introduced to water, you know, a body of water to get into or not get into. And the whole idea of sickness, I mean, is it dogs don't have so much sudden death. For the most part, they don't have a seizure or a heart attack and just, you know, keel over. They tend to go down a slippery slope of just whatever is going to take them out, general old age or illness takes them down that slope. What about the very overused phrase, which I think is really hard for people to deal with? Well, my dog's really old. I don't know if I should do euthanasia. I don't know what his quality of life is like. And they teach you all these ways, the score of, you know, how many hours they're up and around and eating and wagging, and are they doing those things or not? And then they say the line that I'm sure you have heard many times, your dog will let you know when it's time. Now, what does that mean? That's our perception. Do we think the dog's suffering too much? Does the dog go out like one of my dogs did and lie down in 30-degree weather outside and just look like she was almost dead already, but she was ambulatory? She was saying, yeah. I got to die. I cannot. I'm done. And she had stomach cancer. But she totally told me. I couldn't wait till that afternoon till the vet could come and put her to sleep at home. I put her in my car with the help of my sister and drove her to the vet because Lulu was saying, I'm done. This is it. But every dog does that.
No. And you know, there's a number of brilliant points here. Number one, all dogs are individuals. And if you really know your dog, you get a pretty good feeling over the years of what they're telling you. And I don't, you know, once again, I don't know that they're necessarily saying like, you know, you or I might say in words, okay, I'm ready to go, please end it all.
Right.
But they're doing things that are out of the ordinary, and they're attracting your attention. And then you combine that with the fact of how they have been, you know, how their behavior changed over the last week or month. And that's what I had to do with Jethro. You know, I mean, the last dog with whom I lived, was it was just really clear there was something off, and he was going outside and he would squat to poop and he would fall into the poop and
yes.
he couldn't lift his leg. And was he humiliated?
Very good
I don't
question.
Know,
yes.
But I can really tell that he was off and he did not like, if you will, what his life was like. So I made an appointment with my vet. We talked. She had some older dogs. I trusted her beyond belief. And she said, okay, I said to her, if Jethro were your dog, what would you do? And she said, I'd love him for a few days. And I think he's telling you something. And so I put him in the car, which he loved. I'm driving down the mountains to the vet. And there's Jethro running around the back, barking at everything like he hadn't done in 6 months.
It's confusing.
when I got to the vet, I had lived with enough dogs, if you will, and also knew him well. I knew that he was having a last fling, if
yes,
you will, because
yes.
he couldn't get out of the car. He couldn't walk to the vet. And by the time we walked the 10 or 15 meters to the vet's, the office door, he was dragging his back legs. He was peeing and somewhat pooping. And so my take on it, to be honest, was I'm glad he had his last two
yes.
raw. Because
yes.
when he was in the car barking at squirrels and at people, I knew he was happy at some point. So that's what I tell people. And that's why, you know, I always say, if you're living with a dog, get to know that dog as an individual, and you'll get a pretty good feeling when they're happy or sad or grieving, or just telling you, you know, I think I'm done here.
Yes. And the done here usually is as the dog is aging. You know, I've got this whole new thing on my website. I'm now saluting all the senior dog rescues, like, hooray for all the people that rescue the oldsters. And they always say, this dog was, you know, on the euthanasia list at the shelter. There was no hope. Has this, that, and the other physical and emotional downturn. Maybe it's a hospice dog. Maybe a month, 2 months, 18 months, 2.5 years later, these dogs have revived. Now, those aren't dogs that we were living with and knew. Those are dogs that somebody had stopped paying attention to and had stopped looking after their bad old teeth and whatever their problems were. And as soon as they got better nutrition and a vet visit and maybe some dental and someone saying, hey, you're super special, I'm going to give you great golden years, the dog's like, all right, I'm in. You know, it's
yep.
So for the dogs that we've never met, they have like that burst of barking at the squirrels that Jethro had. They could have that for months because no one has offered it to them in a way. But those dogs still do reach that point where they say, yep, thank you so much, but I think I'm kind of worn out now. And it's very touching. Do they know they're dying? No. Do they know that they're kind of used up and don't feel that good anymore and there's really not much more that they want done to them to feel better? Yeah, I think so. Don't you?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, once again, while I could read the dogs, you know, with whom I lived and a lot of their friends and the dogs I know, there are dogs I can't read. I just had
I had an interesting
interaction with a dog who I met a while ago who's turned into a bit aggressive and a young dog, a young big dog. And I realized that I knew him well enough to make certain, if you will, assessments of what he was thinking and feeling, but not well enough. So I actually talked to his human and a woman who's working with him, who's a wonderful trainer. And I realized that, yes, I know him, but I don't know him well enough to make any great statements with any 100% accuracy.
Right, because you don't know him that well. Something you're doing is making your line crackle, Mark. I don't know what it is. If you have any control over it, don't be crackling.
I'm moving
good.
The phone.
Okay, good.
Is that better?
Yes, way better, yes. So sorry, everybody, for the crackling, but those were the words of wisdom that came through about the fact that unless you really know the dog, you can't really assess them. If they're 2 years old and have become aggressive, is it a personality defect? Is it a growth moment? Are they hurting somewhere? And the same thing with dying. I mean, just because your dog seems to be on a downturn doesn't mean they're dying. Maybe they just need, like, you know, a really good vet checkup. We have to mention that as well. A dog could feel like they're dying, like we could feel perfectly dreadful, and then we can get fixed up by modern medicine. So,
exactly.
You know, it's complicated, and you can certainly have a six-year-old dog that has serious problems, like my thrown-away Rottweiler that was thrown away in the road when he was 8 weeks old because he had no hip sockets, and we learned how to deal with that, but then he got long bone cancer in a front leg, so you couldn't amputate a front leg because he had no hind end. So at six, you're taking him to put him to sleep. Does he know he's dying? No. I gave him a new toy the night before. He loved it, but he couldn't stand up. So, you know, that's really, that's the harsh ones where we know we have to let them go because at any moment that leg could break and they also can't get up and they're 100 pounds. So do we, you know, it's also our perception and what we bring to the table and our own ideas about death and dying. Mark, we've run out of time, but it's such a great conversation, such a great topic, and just another thing for people to think about. Part of the love triangle between you and the dog and the other dogs or the vet or other humans in your life, right?
Yep. That's all what you just said is the bottom line to so many things I do is I just want people to think about these things.
Yes, absolutely.
And I'm open to lots of different interpretations, but I want to know they're thinking about them, and I want to know that they're thinking about them with respect to dogs who they know really well. And that, once again, swings back. If you're going to bring a dog into your home, become fluent in dog and pay careful attention to all the junk that's out there. Sorry, I just have to say that.
Thank you. I'm glad you did. And a very last note is go to Psychology Today online and look at the wonderful, wonderful, wonderful articles that Mark has written. Thanks again for being here, Mark. We got to fly. But yes, pay attention to the smart ones. Take care. This show is also brought to you by Evermore Pet Food, which is privately owned by Hannah and Allison, two women who make freshly cooked dog food that ships directly to your home. They source organic vegetables and use only humanely raised meats, all of which would be safe for people to eat. Gently cooked, then frozen in sealed pouches, Evermore beef, turkey, or lamb dinners can be served as a complete balanced meal for your dog or as part of her diet. This show is also supported by Earth Animal, which is privately owned by Dr. Bob and Susan Goldstein, who have combined science and nature in creating many unique products for animal wellness. Dr. Bob has developed a full line of flea and tick products which use no harsh chemicals, and Earth Animal's Zen Pens deliver precisely dosed CBD gel made from full-spectrum hemp oil, which you can rub inside a dog or cat's ear to help with pain or anxiety. I am here with Steve Carino, who has written a book called Oliver, The True Story of a Stolen Dog and the Humans He Brought Together. And it really is a riveting story. A wonderful co-author has taken all the threads of your life, Steve, and not just told this very seat of your chair story of Oliver having been stolen, but also your whole life that led up to your devotion to him. Welcome to the show and congratulations for getting Oliver back.
Thank you.
Very much. That, of course, is the most important part of the whole story, that I got him back.
It is. You know, so many of us say, oh, my dog's my best friend, and oh, I'd just be devastated if I lost him. I think what's most touching about the book is the way in which you depict your whole life from the time you were little, your relationship and close relationship with your mother, your difficult relationship with your father, and the fact that you never quite amounted to what they thought you could or what you hoped you could, and you had made peace through the dogs that you've loved, with being a driver, with being a chauffeur, and having wonderful clients, and but having a very regular guy kind of, I'm grateful for what I've got, but it's not a lot kind of guy. And this dog really was your life. Do you know many other people that could say, I know you have a family full of dog loving sisters, but do you think there's many people who can say that dog is my life? Without him, I don't have one.
Without him, I don't have one. People that live alone, I mean, I live alone.
Yes.
In a cottage, so it's magnified more. I think that the people that I drive for, they have dogs. And it's funny, when I see the dogs, they're loving, and the dogs are part of the family. But they're not the central existence of
right.
the family,
mm-hmm.
even though they feel their love. And I'm sure if the dog went missing, the family would be devastated. But I do think that there are people, again, not any more important that live alone, but the love and the feeling of wisdom, I think, that I learned from Oliver and Mickey and my dogs is magnified when you live alone, when you have that kind of life, especially, you know, hard day's work, driving on the Deacon, going to New York, going to airports, knowing that Oliver was a next door neighbor being watched by my neighbors as sweethearts, and they'll watch him if I have a particularly long day. And I can remember just coming up through Bedford, anticipating, you know, going to their house and sliding the glass door open and Oliver just being there, and Mickey too, because Mickey was there for most of those years. That love saved my life in very dark moments. So I do think there are people that feel that same love. I think they can be a central existence because their love is true, it's unconditional. And if you really delve into the eyes of a dog, the wisdom, they know how to live in the moment. They never judged where I lived. Every other house around here is bigger than where I live. And Oliver never would say, hey, you know, hey, Dad, you know, what are we doing living in this place? How come we don't, you know? No, he doesn't care. So that was lifting me up through the years of, you know, 15, 16, 17, and 18, when my life was indeed coming together, and I was becoming more appreciative about who I was, learning who I was, which was really one of the central themes of the book. And that's why Alex was so adept at listening to my life and agreeing that I didn't want to go into my life to let people know, you know, how my childhood was. What I tried to do was build this bridge from the unconditional love that I had lost from my mother dying when I was 13, and the dogs playing a role in saving me, and coming back now to this in my late 50s and having this story to tell, that that they provide the love that I had lost at an early age.
I think that the depiction, you said that really well, and I do think there are very many touchstones in this book that any of us can relate to. The thing that I most admired was your openness about saying, listen, I live in a rented cottage and I don't have a significant other, and I've struggled with alcoholism, and my father was an abusive alcoholic. But there's nothing in the book that's, oh, you know, this boy's life getting thrown against a wall. It was more the inner person who has made peace with being a driver. I mean, many of us have been driven by somebody. How often have we stopped to think, what is that person's life like? And what I love about the book is how often you stop when you're in these neighborhoods in Mount Vernon, which I didn't realize it was a hood still. I know it used to be really rough. It still is. And you show such appreciation and empathy for the people who helped you, car mechanics, a young Middle Eastern couple who were eventually the ones that found him, or that it came to them, that Oliver came to them, and their messy life with they just moved in and they had a new baby. There's a sense that, you know, the reward money that they got changed their lives for the better. And you had I think it was an uncle who gave you the first reward money you posted. You didn't have $2,500, or if you did, it was all the money you had in the world.
I did. It was all the money I had. And then when he found out, he knew, being my mother's younger brother, he knew the difficulties I had had in my life. And when he heard that Oliver went missing, he was just devastated. And he offered to double the reward, which was a wonderful gesture. And it really made me start to realize that, wow, you know, there are people that really do care about me. Again, when you live alone for a while and your relationship is, gone to ashes years ago.
Yes.
You tend to think that you're alone. And the two saving graces were my dogs and my clients. And in many ways, because I do feel that this came from somewhere else, the universe was almost conspiring to say to me, hey, Stephen, you're not as alone as you think. And unfortunately, we're going to have to take your dog to make you realize this. And in many ways, it was the most difficult week, but the most beautiful week of my life. And it's life-altering. And the people in Mount Vernon, New York, you know, there's a line in the book about Rolando. I said to Rolando, you know, everybody here, it's just been helping me. My sister's running up to strangers. My sister's like a bull in a china shop.
Right.
She was going to get this dog back, and she was handing out flyers. Like, Lori, don't go up to those kids. I'm going up to everybody. But she went up to them with love and with compassion and giving the flyers out and talking to people. And this was before they knew of the reward money, because I know some people might say, well, you know, there was reward money. Of course, they're going to be nice. But this was before we had the flyers. We were talking to people. And Rolando had said to me, and we quoted him in the book, that I said, you know, the people here are so nice. And he goes, well, he goes, it works both ways. He goes, you're not judging anybody.
Nice.
You come down here and you're just, you know, you're just asking us to help you. He goes, you know, we're people just like you are, you know, and but you're not judging us, you know. And that was a great line, and that was a great moment with Rolando. And I guess because of what I had been through in my life, because I had a very interesting question asked me last week. When you open the door of the car and Oliver was gone, from the beginning, you rendered no hatred towards the person who did it. And I said very clearly, yes, I hated the act. To go inside my car and steal my life, I don't like. I'm not going to candy coat it. I hated it. But I remember this feeling coming over me that I was thinking, what would compel somebody to do something like this? And what is this person lacking in their life that they would steal my dog? And I almost, it goes back to what Marcus Aurelius said. I do a lot of reading of these Stoics, and he had said you almost feel pity on the person that's doing it. And I did. And so from that moment, anybody that was involved in my story, there was no hatred towards the person who did this. We don't know where this person comes from. There's enough judgment. There's enough hatred in the world. I'm not going to add to it. And I felt that was part of the test that maybe my parents were giving me, maybe God was giving me, saying, how is he going to act? I spent 2018 reciting and memorizing the third proverb. And it was almost like he was giving me this chance to enact the third proverb in real time, put it to use, and I want to see if you can do it. And I felt that there was no way I was going to judge the people or the person involved with this act. And that was very important, because there were some messages on social media, not very nice, and I immediately would write someone and say, take it down. I don't want any of this. It's not about this awful act. You know, we know that there's enough judgment. And I don't know if it would have happened to me 20 or 30 years ago, if I would have reacted the same. But being put through the tests of life for 55 years, there was no way I was going to revert to some sort of hatred for that. Now, as I say in the book, I did rant and rave and scream at my parents and at the sky upwards for a couple of days because I was so devastated that Oliver was missing. But that seemed okay because I eventually asked for their forgiveness. But I thought it was very important for my soul, for who I am, not to hate the person. And when I met that person face to face, that there was no hatred towards him, and he genuinely felt awful about the fact that it wasn't just a dog he took. He destroyed my life. He didn't know that. So that was a very, very big moment for me personally in my life, and I realized I'd come a long way. I remember leaving the apartment that day, and I kind of patted myself on the back, and I said, "Stephen, you know, you've been beaten up for 50 years, and you did real good this morning. You should be proud of yourself." And I don't say that very often. You know, we are our worst critics, and I have spent a good part of my life beating myself up. And that morning, I remember just saying, "You know what? You did it right. You should be very proud of yourself." And
that comes across in the book. It comes across that with your sorrow being so profound and 7 days having gone by, which was an insane amount of time. I mean, someone said to you, you know, after 3 days it goes cold, and we all watch these TV shows. Oh, after 24 hours, the person will be dead.
Right.
You know, these sort of tick-tock. But you had this army of people. Your sister was certainly the commander. Going into every possible neighborhood, putting up flyers, doubling the reward, asking people, going back to people you'd asked, and a kind of a web of people, some of whom had seen the dog, thought they'd seen the dog, didn't realize
they'd
seen.
We just kept missing them.
Yeah.
Kept missing them.
Right. You could. I mean, it was really that kind of a story. Oh, my God, if only they'd been there half an hour sooner. But when you came upon the troubled young man who had taken him, and you knew it was he, and you'd already been to his mother's apartment, and he'd been blamed for many things, including the car that he took Oliver in was a stolen car. You didn't want to kill him. You never said, I just want to slay this person who cut out my heart. You did have compassion for him, and you saw possibly some part of yourself at that age of a lost soul who was just trying to survive in his own sort of fractured way. I think the book is wonderful, Steve. We only have a little bit of time left, but I do want to say that clearly religion plays a large part in the book. It's published by a religious publisher whose some other books they've published I've talked to the authors about before, and religion didn't play a very overt part in the story. But here it does, and the third psalm is recounted at the end of the book in its entirety. And I think it's wonderful that you were able to fall back on your childhood Italian American Catholic faith and be able to recognize that there was some pattern here, even if it's only you seeing the pattern, even if it's only you imagining that this is a test and you're Job. It's wonderful that you were able to make a story for yourself that had a positive outcome and had positive messages for yourself and about the world. And I think one comes away from the book with a greater appreciation of the people around us, that everybody is a person, as you say, just maybe trying to climb out of the darkness, because everyone has bits and pieces of darkness, and dogs help us do that. So I want to thank you again for having told the story. I'm so glad you got Oliver back. We have run out of time, but I can't say enough good things about this book. I read it cover to cover. Oliver, the true story of a stolen dog and the humans he brought together, and there's a young people's version of it for kids. It's lovely. So I recommend it for reading groups and just for an uplifting story in times when we need uplifting. Thank you for being here. Take care, Steve.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the guests as much as I did. Kiss your kitties and hug your pooches, and we will talk again next week. Bye for now.